So when we think about maker learning, and I want to be clear that this learning can take place in many spaces. They can be classroom environments. They also can be digital environments incorporating digital tools as well as physical modalities. And when we think about this concept of learner variability and how do we really offer opportunities for all students to engage in identifying authentic problems, developing authentic solutions and prototypes and being able to test them, I think that there's a lot of opportunity to expand our view on that.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Cindy Burnett.
And my name is Dr. Matthew Werwood.
This is the Fueling Creativity Podcast.
On this show, we'll be talking about creativity topics and how they apply to the field of education.
We'll be speaking with scholars, educators, and resident experts about their work, challenges they face, and digging deeper into new and varying perspectives of creativity.
All with the goal to help fuel a more rich and informed discussion that provides teachers and parents with knowledge they can use at home or in the classroom.
So let's begin. Today, we will be speaking with Caroline Habig. Based in Wisconsin, Caroline has extensive experience designing and leading professional learning for teachers, instructional coaches, and administrators nationwide. She is the author of the Maker Playbook, Designing Inclusive Learning Experiences, a book for K-12 leaders and educators. An accomplished educator, Caroline has received numerous awards in education, including Apple Distinguished Educator and ISTE Award winner, to name a few. Welcome, Caroline.
Great to be here.
In our past episodes, we focused our attention toward the teacher and the classroom environment, which typically serves an individual class of students. However, in this episode, we're going to look at makerspaces or design studios that might be located in the school building and available to every student. So, Caroline, to begin, I wondered if you could tell us how you view the makerspace movement today and tell us what you mean by a high-impact, inclusive maker learning culture.
Absolutely. So when we think about maker learning, and I want to be clear that this learning can take place in many spaces. They can be classroom environments. They also can be digital environments incorporating digital tools as well as physical modalities. And when we think about this concept of learner variability and how do we really offer opportunities for all students to engage in identifying authentic problems, developing authentic solutions and prototypes, and being able to test them, I think that there's a lot of opportunity to expand our view on that. I do believe a lot of schools and school systems that have dedicated makerspaces and design studios, that those places and capacities also offer unique opportunities. So while we can extend the learning practices for maker learning and design thinking to a variety of environments, when we look at schools that have these specific spaces and capacities, they often allow for a little more flexibility, sometimes some storage, sometimes they house technologies that you wouldn't necessarily want moving around for precision reasons or aren't necessarily affordable at a scalable level for every classroom. So I think as we look at defining what is an inclusive maker learning culture, always starting with, you know, the learning and then moving into how do we have a variety of resources and different modalities that kids can use to engage in design thinking and problem solving?
That latter point is the fact that, yes, you know, the maker learning can take place in any environment. And I think particularly as we hopefully come out of the pandemic, we have recognized the fact that it can also take place remotely and online as well. And perhaps we don't lose that piece. But I think the idea of a school that might be strapped for resources can identify a space, a physical space outside the classroom environment that contains different tools, different resources that students don't normally have access to in that learning environment. And of course, with those resources available to them, students are able to come up with new and different ideas, have opportunities to create different things and express their knowledge in different ways that they might not typically do within the classroom environment. But then also, we want to make sure that that environment isn't necessarily committed to one domain or one type of resource. And I think that some schools can sometimes make the mistake of, okay, well, we're doing a makerspace, so we've got to have 3D printers, and a makerspace or an innovation space is with computers. And you're reminding us the fact that no, actually, it can just be with toilet rolls and paper and scissors and a whole bunch of other different things as well.
I have a question. So how do you encourage educators who are in different domains to come and use the makerspace to their advantage?
That is a wonderful question, because I will also say that when it comes to really thinking through the pieces of maker learning, I would encourage teachers and educators of all different capacities to look at through a couple different lenses. One, using that design thinking process as a way to guide students and to scaffold students in terms of identifying and solving some sort of authentic problem and the scaffolding that's needed for it. So start with like, what do students already need to know and do? And as we think about the resources you have available, then think about how can our process look, but really bringing it back to that problem solving. That's one lens. Another lens that I think a lot of times people do is think of more shorter design exercises that allow students to create and test prototypes without going through a lot of detail in each phase of the design thinking process. But I think most importantly, I understand that there is some value to, you know, exploration, but anything we can do to help students go into that space with a purpose and an intention, the better the outcomes will be. And the really starting with, no matter what your standards are, your learning intentions, you know, use that to guide. Have it make a connection to the work that you already have in place, but to provide different opportunities and modalities for students to engage in that work. And I think a lot of times people say like they don't know where to start. And that's why I hear that a lot. And I always like to encourage people like, well, start with one, you know, what you're already having to cover. Tap into student wonderments, tap into connections to your community or the world around them, have students generating questions. Those can also be a way to help teachers think about what direction can we go with this, and then providing the supports for students so that, you know, they know how to maximize their time in that space. They know how to maximize collaboration in that space or individual work, either way. And they know how to maximize the resources. Because I also know that when we talk about shared spaces and we talk about design studios and maker spaces, the reality is a lot of times there are, you know, budget constraints or resource constraints, and anything that can be done to help people maximize those resources intentionally, whether it's like, hey, certain materials are semi-consumable, meaning we can use them, but we're going to take them apart and put them away afterwards. Or it's a technology that we're not going to put glue on, or it's, you know, some materials that are completely consumable. I think little things like that, if you're operating that space, can also help guide people in their use of it once they've determined those larger pieces of how are we going to engage students from a learning perspective.
Would you say that the making aspects is, because there's a lot of conversations within creativity and problem solving, is the placing emphasis of obviously conducting design research, getting to know the needs of the end user, understanding the context to which your solution is going to actually breathe and exist. But also the very nature of a makerspace suggests that the students need to make something, to experience making something, and then obviously to have opportunities to see that thing that they've made interact with other people. So is it all part of the process, or is there maybe opportunities to do the front part outside of the makerspace? And so when you enter it, it's like, okay, you've identified your problem, you know your end audience, and this is where you go into the design and development phase.
I would say that is very common to start this process within your more typical classroom setting, classroom environment, learning environment. And then when we get to really help students understand what, or and teachers in the case, understand what prototyping is, how these design studios and makerspaces offer the supports for that phase of the work. I think another element of it just can relate to what are features or resources in that space that support the different parts of the design process. And some may focus more heavily on the prototyping piece and the prototype testing piece than maybe the ideation piece that comes before, meaning that, you know, I think you also have to think about, you know, what do our spaces and our in learning environments offer, and how do we maximize all areas of it? But I definitely would agree that helping learners as well as educators think about what prototyping is and the purpose it serves, and making that connection to your makerspace and design studio resources can be really effective. And then also, I continually encourage people to think about, you know, the digital versions as well as, you know, your more basic materials, raw materials that you can use as well for prototyping.
Can you tell us more about some of the raw materials that you would recommend a makerspace should have? Because I know a lot of teachers, especially that are building these kinds of studios, these makerspaces, they're looking for, so what's the basic list? What would you recommend? And then what would be the, it would be great ifs to have in your maker studio?
Oh, that is such a challenging question to grapple with. I do have some ideas and recommendations, but I will say that that sounds like such an easy thing, but it's really hard when you are faced with, say, a budget or no budget in the sense of you're trying to just figure it out based on maybe even donations. One thing that I think is really powerful is providing, whether it's large pieces of paper, or for some schools, maybe it's more whiteboards, but places where sketching can take place. Because the more students can sketch out their ideas or create storyboards, depending on what their product is, the better before they kind of dive in. So having, whether it's maximizing just like basic types of large paper, markers, colored pencils, I know those are so basic, but that sketching piece is really important before kids start to build. Also, cardboard is another fabulous resource. Something that I think is really useful, there's something called Make-A-Do's that allow you to, they're reusable, but, and they look like screws, plastic screws for like a bad, lack of better terms. And you can make cardboard movable in different ways. And obviously you'd want to help kids understand like what you're not going to throw the make-a-do's out. You're not going to take them home. Those are a piece to keep, but they can add a lot to a very basic resource such as cardboard, which could be easy to get for donation. I also encourage people to look at different types of products that students can create, whether it's looking at using technology. So for example, the Morphe app, if you use iPads, is really powerful for 3D design and modeling. And it also has like an AR component. So it's like, you know, if you're making something in particular and you kind of want to see what would it maybe look like in a specific space, it allows you to do that. And I really like tools that help students visualize their designs instead of going just straight to printing, 3D printing, and focusing more on what is that ongoing digital space for creating, or looking at Tinkercad, and then even looking at creating animation, say something as basic as using Scratch Junior and Hopscotch can be really great tools to help students think through different types of products that they can create if you're going in the more digital realm. And then also looking at, you know, there are pieces that you may end up printing, but then there's pieces you may not end up printing. And that's okay. There's ways to share that work. There's ways to engage with others around it and to have that exchange of feedback as well. Those are like two really big ends of the spectrum, just materials that allow students to develop and put things there, whether it's cardboard and looking at glue guns and tape and make-a-do's, to then looking at what is that digital side that offers us a lot of opportunity for authentic prototyping as well. And I'll think more about like other key things. I'm sure they'll pop up. Also, sometimes you want to look at if you're doing skill builders or you're doing anything with programming and robotics, having those types of items there can be a great way to teach a skill, create an awareness that then students can apply later on to a solution that they're developing. There's a couple of different varieties of these types of activities out there. For example, the game Disruptus is very common. It has like different images and pictures where basically you're taking two disparate ideas, colliding them together to develop something new. This is a really great exercise to help people, whether you're a younger learner or an adult learner, in terms of thinking, you know, who might I be solving a problem for, looking within constraints. I remember we had some second graders doing this. It's also a great way to kind of work on those team building collaboration feedback skills. Is this one team had a coat hanger and like a hello name tag. And at first you might be thinking, what the heck are you going to do with that? And the second graders just said, you know, we notice that people in our neighborhood and our subdivisions don't talk to each other a lot. And we don't really know our neighbors. So what if we, you know, within these constraints, made an invention called Hello Neighbor, where we could slide notes like back and forth. I know it sounds like the old like soup can telephone, but it was really interesting how even something as basic as an exercise as that can get kids making those connections to the world around them and their communities. And then another resource that I think is so powerful, created by a friend and colleague of mine, Douglas Keon, one game that he has, it's cards you can buy online. It's called Mission Feature Feature. And what's neat about that is it's about different ideas around app design and thinking about what features you're assigned. So you must have these features, but then there's a mission, like here's the purpose. And how would you creatively use these features to solve some sort of problem? And then getting kids thinking about, well, what impacts positive and negative, you know, strengths and weaknesses might this have on society? So I think tools that really get kids thinking about, one, constraints, but then also opportunities, I think are very valuable to bring in your makerspace as well, because we want to also engage kids in the different types of thinking that they can do that goes along with and is also ongoing and the precursor to the actual making of prototypes.
One, I really valued the emphasis you placed on paper prototyping. So even before you know, whether it's a video game or you know, a movie, paper prototyping is so important. And you can, of course, once that's getting the idea out there and that idea can then be shared with others for feedback. And then there was something else that you referenced at the very end that I thought was important. And I just want to kind of like do a somewhat of a follow-up question is an earlier episode with David Cropley, we started to talk about the importance of incorporating design ethics when it comes to creating and making. And so you spoke a little bit about, you know, getting students to think about, you know, the impact this has on society and outside the classroom environment. And so I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more on how a teacher might go about doing that, particularly in situations where they might actually have the constraint of the fact that the product that they're creating might not actually get out or might not have an opportunity to get out into the environment to which it's being designed for.
I think that first off, that's very, very common. Actually, when we first started this whole journey of developing this culture of maker learning at the systems level, it was helping even educators understand what is prototyping and what's its purpose. Because at first, teachers were confused, like, well, but they're not really going to make XYZ. You know, it's like, no, they're not going to have like a ready to market, whatever product solution. It's about that process in between. But I think what's really important is asking and intentionally inviting students to think about how might this solution have an effect on other people, on the environment, not only maybe specific users, but more general. And I think the more intentional we can be about bringing those types of questions into our prototyping testing process, I think can be really helpful. And I think that it's a really good question because it helps kids think about their solution or their product and prototype in a variety of contexts. And I like that not only, you know, might they be thinking about a specific user, but think about society as a whole. What might that impact be?
So Caroline, in your book, you discuss the value of helping educators to find entry points in their standards and curriculum for maker learning. What would you say to teachers who are not sure where to start?
You know, what's fascinating is that there's so many different angles that you can actually find an invitation or an opportunity into design and maker learning. So sometimes it's about taking a problem that students are reading about, learning about, may have been faced in different ways. So for example, if you're reading about in social studies or different historical time periods, thinking about like what are problems people are facing, how might that, you know, given the constraints of that time, what could a solution have been? Or if it were today, what would that have been? I think even sometimes looking at, you know, what is something that people within our own classroom struggle with? I mean, I'll give an example here, like having taught like advanced placement psychology and other psychology and sociology. Sometimes people are like, well, where would this even fit? And I would think, okay, you know, what could be really interesting is understanding something kind of abstract, like how a neuron fires is a hard thing to understand. So even, you know, but my students had to be able to not only understand it, but then be able to articulate that process and its impact, like if something goes wrong. And, you know, having a challenge where students are like, hey, you say that you're designing a product or a process to help teach family members about the impact of Parkinson's or Alzheimer's as it has to do with neurons, or you're trying to explain how a neuron fires or what happens if there's a disruption there, and having kids develop like, okay, how would I teach this to someone else? What could I create to take this really abstract concept and break it down for a particular user, whether it's a student, whether it's like that pretend scenario of like a family, just different rehab places, like where people would need to gain this information. And I think sometimes it's about thinking about what is it that even kids might struggle with to learn, and how can we put them in this seat of teaching someone else, and finding those like authentic examples for audience is one way. Because I do think sometimes people struggle with, like, especially at the upper age levels and grade levels, when they are dealing with, you know, so much content, is thinking through, well, how can we use this content as a vehicle? And then, say, to go back to that high school psychology example, you know, also taking what did we learn about learning and cognition that impacted your design, right? Like, are there certain things we know about how people learn that you would make one design choice over another? And I think, you know, sometimes it's really thinking about like, you know, what is a real problem that either your students are facing that ties to a connection or implication to the curriculum you're teaching or the subject matter you're teaching. Or sometimes it's even like, hey, how do we create a more inclusive playground? Or we notice that, you know, students are having a hard time working on different listening skills. Like sometimes it's even about like design can even relate to environment, but also a process. And, you know, it's, I think there's a lot of different directions you can go. One thing that I think is also helpful for starting to think about those is when we teach about prototyping, I like showing a lot of different examples about how it could be something like a physical device or tool, but it could also be about an experience, and showing pictures from the real world prototyping of like how close or not close do you need to be to comfortably sleep on an airplane with the people around you, or changes Starbucks has made and having espresso machines a certain height so that you can see that barista and have that personal connection. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to think about prototyping and creativity, and you're not always tied to, we're going to make this to do that, and think more about challenge and process. So I guess to sum up all those wild examples would be, you know, start with what students already have to know and do. Is there a problem being explored already? Are there questions that students have that come out of it, or an application of that learning or material, kind of like in that upper level example I gave, or real, even small world, meaning their classroom environment or community, looking at, you know, what is something that's what's being contemplated or wondered about, and diving into that.
So, Caroline, let's talk a little bit more about that inclusive maker culture. How do you make a culture more inclusive in the maker learning space?
Oh, I love this question, because there are so many pieces that we can think about that are concrete. And I think the best thing that I like about this question is that there are some very actionable pieces, starting points, and resources that I think teachers and educators can include within their makerspace design studios that not only help address learner variability, but also can be a way to use these spaces to teach other educators or model some inclusive practices. So for example, at first blush, these may sound like, oh, well, yeah, that's obvious, that's good teaching, but it doesn't necessarily always happen in reality. So one of my favorite things is having ready-made, ready-to-go, they can be used as entrance or exit kind of ticket reflections. They have to do with different parts of the design process, whether they're a Google form that a teacher scans and like can make a quick copy of, or whether they're little paper tickets. I've done both. And then having a list of that kind of gives teachers the big picture, like, hey, these questions go with this phase, where are we at? Encouraging that formative assessment and reflection by having things kind of ready to go on the fly can be very helpful to teachers. Also providing, having kind of like this either maker checklist type activity, where if a teacher's coming in and they're not as familiar with the makerspace, or they didn't have the time because to create all these extra scaffoldings and supports, having resources available that teachers can either use on the spot or have digitally and modify as needed. So having, say, like this maker space walkabout or checklist, sometimes I call it, where students have to go through and state, you know, what is our problem? What do we think our solution is? What materials might we want to use? Did I do a sketch? You know, all these pieces that also allow them to walk around the space, but then kind of organize a plan that, you know, it sounds like such best practice, but I think for some educators, you know, there's just so many demands people have. The more pieces that we can put in the place to model how to support the learning, the better. Another really big favorite of mine is having sentence stems and starts to assist students, whether it's more basic for collaboration, or I also have one that's specific for the prototyping feedback process. And modeling that, hey, you know, here's a resource. There are laminated sentence stems and starts that you can pass out and have kids using during these phases of the process can be really powerful. Having, you know, just thinking about visuals to help people know how to like put the space back in order. I also have like these cards. I call them cleanup job cards. And yes, they even work at high school where you can just, you know, usually when you're tight on time and you're in a shared space, you have to also think about how do we get it back together and be organized, and having like cards that have specific kinds of jobs. Like this table, you're going to work on putting away materials. You're going to work on making sure our prototype storage is there. You know, there's different jobs, but even little things like that with visual cues can be really helpful. And then having different ways that kids can navigate resources. I know before I talked about the difference between consumable, semi-consumable, and non-consumable resources, sometimes having a visual and a color that also accompanies that term or symbol can be really helpful. So having, I kind of have like pre-made signs that show like, what is the symbol, you know, and then having an image for cutting, gluing, to remember the other one, like keep, take apart, things like that, to help people, mean kids, adults, whomever, navigating the space and having those different ways that students can navigate that environment. Also thinking about how do we use this space to have tools and resources, instructional and learning tools and resources that can support educators as they bring learners into this space. They can be used to model these specific best practices, even having like signage that also has visuals. I know that sounds so basic, but can be really helpful in terms of helping not only, you know, keeping kids on task, but helping them navigate with a purpose, and especially if it's a shared space. Those are just a couple small things to touch on, but I like giving those very concrete examples because teachers don't always have the time to say, okay, now I'm going to create this and we're going to bring it. Now I'm going to create this and we're going to bring it. So the more you can have some of these types of either activities or supports available, I think the better.
Well, thank you so much for all of these tips on maker learning. Now, Caroline, we end every show by asking our guests for three tips they would give educators, school leaders, and parents on how to bring creativity into the classroom. So what three tips would you like to provide?
Ooh, number one, I would say maximize opportunities for students to share curiosities and ask questions, whether it has to do with observations, whether it has to do with thinking about something that they've read or learned about. That can be a jumping off point. I would say providing a scaffolded process so students know, you know, what they're expected to know and do and engage with during specific parts of the design process are really important. There's a lot of videos and resources I mentioned in the book that help to provide those kind of ready-to-go scaffolding pieces. And then my last one, I think maker learning has a lot of opportunity to help kids develop their metacognition, reflection, self-assessment skills, and, you know, getting kids to think about, talk about why they're making decisions the way they are or what they're choosing to do. The more we can work on that, not only does it help with speaking and listening skills, but that reflective, you know, where am I as a learner? Where do I want to be? And what can I do to get there? I think is very valuable. And bringing it into this process has a lot of opportunity.
Caroline, thank you so much. And I think this was an incredible episode for anyone who is looking to either reinvigorate their existing makerspace or build a new makerspace. So if you've got any questions about this episode or past episodes or ideas for future episodes, don't forget you can email Cindy and myself at questions@fuelingcreativitypodcast.com. That's questions@fuelingcreativitypodcast.com. My name's Dr. Matthew Werwood.
And my name is Dr. Cindy Burnett. This podcast was produced by Creativity and Education and in partnership with dadsforcreativity.com. Our editor is Sina Yousefzadeh.